This is R.J. Rushdoony, easy chair number 417, September the 23rd, 1998. Tonight I have with me Douglas Murray, Susan Burns, and Mark Rushdoony, and our format is going to be quite a bit different tonight. Over the years, and as I read off the number 417 as the number of the easy chair, I realized some of you have been asking this from the earliest days. And I give an oral account, if not a written one, on the origins of Chalcedon, what led me to start it. And Douglas, Susan, and Mark will help me clarify that history with their interruptions. Now, an important fact that led to the founding of Chalcedon was the fact that I was a foreigner, an Armenian, the child of immigrants born fairly soon after their arrival in New York City. I was born there, although at 6 weeks we came to California. Now, as a foreigner, I had a very different standard to compare the United States to. The attitude of the foreigners I knew, both Armenians and others, was very, very appreciative of the United States. In fact, I know when I was growing up, many of these people, whether they came from Northern or Central Europe, were often distressed that Native Americans did not appreciate this country sufficiently. Coming from a foreign background, a world of extensive controls, this was a remarkable country, gloriously free. And you must remember that in those days, in the 20s, the number of regulations controlling Americans were minimal. The basic control was Christian. Most people went to church, or at least in much of the country, most did. They were very much under the influence of the teachings of Scripture. As a result, we were still a country then with a Christian background. In the early grades, whether in California or later in the 20s after 25, in Detroit, Michigan, a teacher had only to refer to some aspect of biblical teaching in passing, by way of confirming something that she was teaching, in order to have instant recognition on the part of the students. Everybody knew what she was talking about. I don't think that would be true today. So we had a Christian character, but it was apparent that this was beginning to fade. I had the additional advantage that my father had gone to Scotland early in this century to do his graduate studies at New Mound College and the University of Edinburgh. As a result, he had acquired a very great appreciation for Scottish culture. And as a result, became aware of the theonomic background of Scottish culture. I know that in 1987, on a trip to England, to Oxford, to speak at a conference, there were a couple of Scots there from a remote village. Both of them veterans of the British Army, who came to me in some amusement and said, we've learned from this trip here to this conference that your ideas about God's law are highly controversial. And they said, they're not to us. Everybody in our village and other villages round about believes, obeys, and practices the law of God. So it's very different in out of the way Scotland and in the cities. I'm sure this is true elsewhere in Europe. Well, I became aware of the drift away from a biblical faith and culture very early. It was not pleasant to see, but it was a grim reality. With World War II, the drift became a departure. As a result, I recognized there was a need for some kind of reawakening, something to alert people. My earliest feelings were that maybe I could be a writer and take on the task that way. In those days, and in fact, until after I started Chalcedon in 1965, there were no comparable organizations among Christians. There were the churches and their institutions, some Christian schools underway, but nothing more. Now we have all kinds of Christian newsletters and study groups. I thought hard and long about starting something like Chalcedon. From my student days on, at first, I was not altogether sure what its form would take. I thought of some kind of academic teaching center. I've never abandoned that idea, but I settled with a writing ministry, something in the way of a publication that would go out to interested parties. I began to think very, very seriously about starting such a thing when after my seminary, I went to an Indian reservation to be a missionary there. I felt a real calling to the work because in the 1930s, the number of Christian Indians were half what they were in 1890, 40 to 50 years earlier. So that the drift among Americans was also affecting a group like the Indians. I felt that if I could make the faith plain to the American Indians, who still basically spoke their native tongues and English was a second language, I could then make it clear to anyone. In those years on the reservation, I often thought of Nevada as the place to center Chalcedon when I was able to begin. My reason for that was that I was aware that California was becoming an increasingly regulated state, like most states in the Union. More and more of a person's life was controlled, whereas in Nevada there were very few controls. However, I did settle on California and never regretted it. Now, basic to the idea of Chalcedon was that it was not enough for a person or a culture to accept Christ. They had to be surrendered to Christ and to Christianity, totally controlled by the faith. And of course, this began with biblical law. If you are governed by the faith, it means you are governed by the law of that faith. This, of course, met with resistance from Christians. I found very early, before I reached the Indian reservation, when I had no more than stopped to visit a friend, a pastor, an older man, than when I preached for him, there was some outrage in that I mentioned two things, God's law and victory. Somehow, both constituted a terrible heresy. You were supposed to be a martyr for the faith. It was supposed to lead only to defeat, but you clung to it all the same. And I thought that was terrible. Well, I did pull in my horn, so to speak, on that issue for some time until I was prepared to come out full force with the meaning of theonomy, which I was ready to do late in the 70s or 60s and early in the 70s as I wrote the first volume of Institutes of Biblical Law. The reaction to it was, of course, immediate and intense, both in favor and against it. So the issue was out in the open. I was now something of a marked man, which didn't bother me in the least. But it did trouble some people who were interested, because it meant such an unremitting hostility if they adopted the position to any degree. The first few years from 65 to about 71 or 72, I worked alone, didn't have the funds for anyone else on the staff. The first issue of the Chalcedon Report went out in September or October of 1965. It was a single mimeographed page. Grace Flanagan, who was very much totally in favor of Christian Reconstruction, prepared, ran off, and mailed the copies of issue number one. We ran off 60. We had 51 or two on our original mailing list. For many years, she cut the stencil and mimeographed the report. We quickly went on to 2, 3, and 4 pages. And it was in 71 or 72 that we adopted a printed format. The publication of that Chalcedon Report very early made me a marked man. I was really amazed at the hostility that it incurred. It seems strange to me that anyone could doubt that God, having given the law and having given over a very high percentage of the whole of the Bible to the law, with the rest more or less as a commentary on it, was not in favor of its practice. Yes.
Did they think that God simply submitted this to man for our consideration?
It was for the government of the Jewish tribes. And when the Jewish era of biblical history, the Old Testament, ended, then it was invalid, no longer applicable. That was their stock attitude. And of course, their interpretations of Matthew 5:17 following, where our Lord in the Sermon on the Mount speaks so strongly of the eternal validity of the law, they had all kinds of fantastic interpretations to eliminate the validity of that text. So it was really a startling exercise in antinomianism. And in a sense, I knew I would get hostility. I knew they would not agree because I knew their position. I knew what was in the Scofield Bible and how large a percentage believed it from cover to cover insofar as its notes were concerned. Mm-hmm. And I knew how many modernists prevailed in church after church, and they had their hostility to God's law. God's law was highly unpopular in the church.
Could we back up a little bit?
Yes.
You're already in 65 in the start of the Chalcedon
yes.
report. Fairly soon after you were out of seminary in, what was it, 44?
43 or 44, I think.
Okay, you 43. Went to the Indian Reservation yes. in northeastern Nevada.
Yes.
You were there till 53.
Yes.
And then you pastored two churches in Santa Cruz.
Yes.
Until 1962. Now, in 1962, you went to work for, was it the Volcker Fund?
Yes.
Or was that part of the Pew... The Pew Trust, or
no, it was the Volcker Foundation.
Could you tell us about that? Because that
surely.
You went from there to Los Angeles and really Chalcedon full time.
Surely, the Volcker Foundation had been founded by. This businessman engaged in acting as a middleman in the sale of business and office supplies in the way of furnishings. He would contract with the producers, whether of counters or desks or floor coverings, to be their exclusive distributor. And for many years, whether linoleum or carpet or whatever, all were handled by the Volcker Fund, and all the advertising you saw for that corporation were put into the media by the Volcker Fund. It was a very successful, very wealthy fund. As a result, they accumulated millions. The interesting thing is that young Volcker went to work with virtually no money, and in his teens, when he started this business, and by the time he had come of age, he was already a tremendous and powerful success. Subsequently, he added his nephew, Hal Luno, to the staff. And the two of them more or less ran the company until Volcker's death. Volcker, when he died, wanted the money spent to further Christian and free market causes. He, during his lifetime, had given millions to certain universities and to various medical causes. He anticipated the entire fund being used for such causes, but he knew how very quickly all foundations that had a great deal of money were taken over. So he set up a stipulation that his foundation had to be dissolved within so many years and all the remaining assets given to various groups, because he did not want it to become a champion of the left. Of course, this is what happened to the Pew Trust, and Pew created the wealthiest trust, perhaps, in the United States, goes into the billions, and is now very much controlled by the left. Well, the Volcker Fund was to have been dissolved not too long after I went there. I was taken aboard as an independent consultant towards starting some kind of school. It would be a graduate school, training men in theological and historical studies. I think the name was something like the Center for American Studies. But at any rate, the formation of that school was begun with the formation of a library, and I began buying up thousands of books that were relevant here. And even Cornelius Van Til was sounded out as to whether he would come and be the theologian in residence for this school. However, the hostility it incurred was enormous. First, the idea that I was providing the guidance was appalling to all the professors and scholars who had received grants from Volcker, usually grants for work in economics from a free market perspective. I recall being shown by my friend Ivan Birley a stack of letters several inches high that poured in within a matter of days after my part in all this became known, all objecting to, yes.
What?
I see our time is almost over, so please turn your tape over and we will continue with this easy chair. And I hope you are finding it of interest, because to me, of course, Chalcedon is very important. I was taken aboard the Volcker Foundation as an independent consultant. This meant they were not accountable for everything I said or did, and I was not accountable for all they said or did. That was the work of Ivan Birley, who was the man who took me in. He had shown an interest some time before, and I received a grant to do further writing on the messianic character of American education from them. I had already written, By What Standard, my first book, in the middle of the 70s, then Intellectual Schizophrenia, and the book on education,
Messianic Character.
Messianic Character of American Education came out at the very end of 1963. So I had already written those three books, and while at Volcker, I completed a few others, including, with another grant from Volcker, when I was dropped from the staff, so to speak, The One and the Many. But
that wasn't published for several years, though, was it?
No, it wasn't, because we had to publish it, and it was not cheap. The interesting thing is that uh, Now that I was on my own, there were those who felt that I would wither and fall by the wayside because I didn't have the financial support. Volcker gave me a terminal grant of 2 or 3 years funding, and with that, of course, I was able to survive until Calcedon could begin operation. I had already incorporated some time earlier, but the hostility was such that I knew that it was going to be very difficult to start Calcedon. Who would fund it? I was notorious. I know that thanks to one or two friends, notably Ivan Birley, I had had a review of Intellectual Schizophrenia published in National Review, and a very good one. Later, another was done of The Messianic Character of American Education, which was a somewhat left-handed one because Volcker was no longer in a position to give money to National Review, perhaps. But at any rate, we were then living in Palo Alto, where I was working on my research grant, and the money was running out. And it was difficult to visualize what was ahead. I hoped that I could find a small church where the demands on my time would be minimal, and where I could preach and yet continue writing. Dorothy and I looked up and down the state of California to see if we could find such a church, and we could not. Then Gary North, who had been staying with us that previous summer, because I had gotten him one of the last grants from Volcker to do some independent studying, was in a bookstore in Westwood in Los Angeles and met two or three women who had a study group, and he urged them to invite me to go down there and speak. So, led by Grace Flanagan, they did. And subsequently, two other groups, one in Pasadena and one in Orange County, also invited me. But the response I got in Los Angeles, Westwood, was exceptionally good. And the meetings were attended by women, but then on one occasion where it was possible, a number of men were present. And what they said was that they were, as a result of their adoption of a conservative outlook, becoming interested in the Christian faith. They wanted some solid teaching. Most of them were starting to attend one church or another, but they were getting nothing of the sort. Would I go down there and hold a class for them? So we moved there with almost no assurance of any support from this handful of people. Grace Flanagan found that a couple of women had an acquaintance with Walter Knott of Knott's Berry Farm. So they took me there, and I talked to him, and I spoke strongly about Christian education and my work there. And I felt the future of the country required reconstruction beginning in education. He immediately objected. He was an old man. He wanted to win this country politically and to see it return to the standards, the Christian standards he'd known as a boy. Later, when he was no longer in control and had barely survived death, he was in his office cleaning out his desks and bookcases, and he learned that I was there on the premises. He asked me to come in, and he very humbly told me that if he had put the money into Christian schools that he had into politics, the country by this time would be a different country. Well, he put up $1,500 to start me off, and Phil Virtue of a furniture manufacturing company put up another $1,500. So we had $3,000, enough to keep me going a couple of months. And so we moved down there. It was a movement by faith, because I had no way of knowing when the $3,000 was exhausted, 2 months' pay, whether I would be able to make a go of it. After all, it was just a handful of people. Then, of course, a group, as a result of a meeting or two I held before we moved down to keep building up the group, led to some in the Pasadena, San Marino area expressing an interest, and others in Santa Ana. The Santa Ana group was made up of breakaway Episcopalians who were starting an independent Episcopal movement, and while one of their vestrymen could take over the liturgical aspect of the service, they hoped would do the preaching, which I did then and for a few years thereafter, until they had grown enough to call a pastor. Well, the move was a dramatic one. It was a move dictated by faith. We had most of the things going by truck. We had, while visiting, signed a lease for a home in Canoga Park. We were on our way.
Woodland Hills.
Woodland Hills, you're right, Mark. First of all, Woodland Hills. The interesting thing was that here we were on our way with, this was 1965, with two old blue 1949 or 1950 Plymouths. They were good cars. I Wish I had one now. They would run forever. And we had problems along the way. It was a particularly hot summer day. And the Plymouth Dorothy was in, together with Gary, boiled quite a bit on the way. But we got there, went into the house, and it was insufferable. The heat had built up all through the day because it was all closed. But we got settled, and I began my work there. So it was quite an effort. On Sundays, I would begin at 10 or thereabouts and continue for an hour and a half with questions and answers in Westwood at Phil Virtue's office's conference room.
Well, weren't you first in Sunday morning, weren't you, in Santa Ana at the Episcopal service?
Yes, but then I would go to Santa Ana.
Okay.
This was at the same time.
Okay.
I began first in Westwood.
Okay.
Then I would hold an afternoon service there, and then would drive back, get a bite to eat, and go to San Marino in the evenings for the services there. So I was doing a great deal of traveling. In fact, I covered a considerable number of miles. Now, the interesting thing about that is that as a result of those meetings, a number of people became Christian, and a number started going to area Orthodox Presbyterian churches. Ironically, in spite of what I was feeding into those churches, and I did have trouble later with the OPC, early on, there were one or two men who were highly critical of me because I was laboring on the Sabbath with all that driving. So even at such a silly point as that, I was not immune to criticism. Meanwhile, as I've indicated, the Chalcedon Report was being put out in mimeograph form by Dorothy and Grace, with Grace doing the bulk of the work. Her children, both of them, were also involved in stuffing the envelopes. The first month it was only 50, but after that it was amazing how quickly it went into several hundred all over the country. People would copy an issue, mimeograph, or Xerox it, and mail it to friends across country, and we would get requests from them, and we began to get contributions from them as well. So we now had these three meetings and our mailing all bringing in some contributions. I was therefore able in the early 70s to add a man to the staff, Gary North. Now, I had found a very fine job for Gary as an economist, which was his field, with a foundation for economic education. However, he became dissatisfied, and with some grounds, on a number of issues, and he left. He went to major coin selling operation in Southern California, but felt before long that their operation had serious flaws morally. So he quit his job there. So he was jobless, and meanwhile he was married to our daughter Sharon. So I invited him to join us at Chalcedon. Shortly thereafter, we began to publish in the early 70s in a printed four-page format, which was later expanded to 8 pages. About that time, a year or two after Gary was brought on board, I invited Greg Bonson, whom I knew from the time he was a child, and I knew his parents well, to join our staff. But it became apparent after a time that Greg's basic concern was academic, and our outlook is one that cuts across subjects. It's to deal not with a particular discipline of study, but the issues of life. So I was able to find a good job for Greg at Reformed Seminary in Mississippi. And then we continued. Well, it became apparent to me that we couldn't continue very long in Canoga Park, and then the last couple of years in Woodland Hills, where we purchased a home. Our lease expired, and the owner of the house was selling it. Well, we therefore bought and did it with the idea and view of moving as soon as we could locate a place in the country. We wanted a center in the country where living costs would be cheap and we could build more readily and expand. Now, where we were, we had a tract house, and a good one, built in 1960 at a cost of $10,000 plus then swimming pool added. Built on a fair-sized lot, incidentally. But that house was increasing in its taxation every year. The saying in the neighborhood was, if you want to live in a better neighborhood, stay put, because the value of the houses is advancing so. I know that before we left, the property tax on our house was $200 a month, $2,400 a year, and it was due any time to go up. And in fact, within a few months, they had reassessed every house in that area, and on our street, the taxes were between $3,800 and $4,200 a year. Well, that's a lot of money. I didn't feel I could afford it. So we had begun to look all over the state for a place where we could build. We finally came because of Dorothy's study of the whole situation to Calaveras County, where the tax rate was low and the regulations minimal at that time, and not too bad yet. Some of the properties I had examined prior to that were remarkable opportunities, but closed ones. I recall looking at a house in Northern California and not too very far from the grape country, but in the Redwoods, 80 acres. The house had been built early in the 1900s by a very wealthy man. It had a double-walled driveway leading into the house. The walls were 6 feet or so high and about, 18 inches of dirt between them, in which trailing vines had been planted that would overflow the walls and add dramatically to the appearance of the place. It was vacant at the time, except for a hippie couple who were living there to watch over the place. It was a stone structure. The basement was a ground floor one. Above that were three stories. It had 21 fair-sized bedrooms, huge rooms on the first floor for a variety of facilities. It was built of stone. A person could have held a small college there, because in the back was a huge carriage barn. The building was two or three stories high also, very solidly built, stone construction for about a floor and a half, and it was very easily alterable into a major building. However, the zoning laws permitted nothing except a single-family residence in a house with 21 bedrooms. Please turn your tape over at this time.
It's the end right here.
We should,
it's the end.
Or rather, turn to tape 2, and we shall continue.